Possibly. And welcome also, this is an event within the Young Researchers Conference. So welcome again, everybody, for the Young Researchers Conference. We will start again with colloquia next year. I will not be the chair, but we will start again on January 14th. And I don't remember the name of the speaker, but we have somebody coming, especially from the Pamela Collaboration, to talk about their very provocative results with positrons and possible detection of dark matter. So we'll get started off in the right way in January. Just after this, so for people from the conference and for everybody, because I want to emphasize it, apparently it's not clear, but everybody in the institute is welcome to come to the talks and encouraged to come to the talks of the Young Researchers Conference. And so directly after this, we'll have Philip Boyle giving the introduction to quantum foundations. Today, we're very, very pleased to end our year of colloquia with Keith Dinas. Keith is a particle physicist and a string theorist. He got his, he got his PhD from Cornell in 1981, and he's now 81.
91.
This is why you're getting a new colloquium chair. And he is at the University of Arizona, and he's going to end our series with a very provocative talk about the landscape of string theory. And he's around till Friday for a conversation.
Yeah, so it's a pleasure to be here, and it's not often I get invited anymore to give a talk to any group that's called Young Researchers. I'll cherish the 91 instead of 81 as long as I can. So it's a pleasure to be here. It's an interesting flight coming from Arizona. You gain 10 degrees latitude and drop about 30 degrees Fahrenheit. So what I'd like to do today is talk about the string landscape. And as you'll see, this is going to be a more recreational talk than maybe some of the others have been. So it's good that it's the last one in your semester. So when I first was invited to give this talk, I thought, okay, well, there's a great topic here. I mean, after all, there are all sorts of people actively buzzing around this, and I'll read this quote from Lenny Susskind. What we've discovered in the last several years is that string theory has an incredible diversity, a tremendous number of solutions, and allows different kinds of environments. A lot of the practitioners of this kind of aesthetical theory have been in a state of denial about it. They didn't want to recognize it. They want to believe that the universe is an elegant universe, and it's not so elegant. It's different over here. It's that over there. It's a Rube Goldberg machine over here. And this has created a sort of sense of denial about the facts of the theory. The theory is going to win, and physicists who are trying to deny what's going on are going to lose. So that's Lenny. Many of you may know him. And so I thought, this is a great topic for a colloquium. But the more I thought about it, I realized, well, I know what it takes to give a good colloquium. There are certain rules about giving a good physics colloquium. The first one is physicists or scientists. Well, you should have. But you know, physicists or scientists, you're supposed to show lots of data from expensive experiments using latest cutting-edge technologies. Another rule is that physicists are conservative. You're supposed to stick to the facts and avoid unnecessary speculation. Another thing is that physicists are logical. You're supposed to adhere to a straight logical line with each result building on the previous one. Physicists are objectivists. They deal in universal truths and fundamental laws, and there's no room for the personal opinions, much less the biases of the speaker. Another one which we all really know, although we don't like to say it, is that physicists are smart. Now, what does this mean? This means really smarter than everybody else, and that especially applies to the social scientists. Never mix physics with non-physics. And then finally, physicists are only human. Like everyone else, they like a good conclusion, a firm punchline, and a tidy final lesson to take away, like this. See the big yellow box, the title. Unfortunately, I realized this colloquium is going to violate all of this, because instead the kinds of questions I'm going to be talking about are completely different. Like, can the ground state of a theory be completely irrelevant to that theory? And are we deluding ourselves by always focusing on the vacuum? What is the boundary between explanation and observation? How can we judge whether a theory is natural? And how can we judge whether one theory might be more natural than another? Or what does it mean for a theory to be predictive or falsifiable? What kinds of numbers should a fundamental theory of physics be capable of predicting? The mass of the electron, the radius of the Earth orbit around the sun, the price of tea in China? This is not a joke. I once was asked to referee a paper for the Canadian Journal of Physics, which tried to relate all three of these, and I rejected it. And now I'm not so sure. What tools are we allowed to use in formulating a scientific theory? The results of experiments, theoretical expectations, ourselves? Are we once again destined to become the center of the universe? To what extent can one talk meaningfully about alternate universes? And are all possible universes created equal? Is the number of possible universes finite or infinite? And is this even knowable? And does it matter? And then finally, is theoretical particle physics destined to become a branch of cosmology? And if you think about all of this, this doesn't sound like physics. It sounds like instead something much worse called philosophy of physics, or maybe even sociology of physics. Or you could call it the first steps on the slippery path to social science. Any word social in the US is a bad word, so this is a bad thing. And the point is, though, that we're currently in the throes of a potentially huge paradigm shift in physics. And my goal in this colloquium is going to be to explain what this is and where it came from. So there's no tidy outcome yet. Instead, I'll just try to convey the sense of excitement and frustration that many in the string community are currently facing. So what I'll do in this talk is I'll review very quickly some very standard particle physics and then some beyond the standard particle physics, and then finally introduce the landscape, which is the basic topic of the talk. That's the first part. I'll then talk about some sample explorations of the landscape. This is the only part of the talk that will have real science in it. But then very quickly, I'll get to the non-science. I'll talk about some cautionary tales. Accounting is hard. Not all vacua are vacua. Discuss natural versus unnatural theories. And is string theory predictive? And should it be? And I'll talk about the multiverse and something called the A word, which you can guess. And the big questions. And then a brief overview followed by an audience free-for-all. Because really, these are controversial topics. And they are at the heart now of what a lot of people are worrying about. So the standard model, you know all this. And I'm not going to. This is not a typical physics department. This is an institute of all theorists. So there are no experimentalists in the room, probably. And moreover, you're all experts in quantum gravity or string theory or quantum information. So a lot of this I don't need to review. But basically, you get down to what's called the standard. Well, you get down reductionistically down to the quarks and leptons. And you know there are various different types. And we have no idea what's beyond this. This is as far as we've come. So basically, what we believe is true at the smallest scales we can probe is what's called the standard model, which is made up of the particles, which are three families of quarks, up, down, strange charm, top, and bottom, and three families of leptons, the electron, the muon, and the tau, and their associated neutrinos. Those are the particles. They feel forces. SU3, SU2, and U1 describe the symmetry groups associated with these forces. And there's the strong color force, SU3, with a fine structure constant associated with it of about 1/8. It holds quarks together to form hadrons and nuclei, and it's felt only by the quarks. There's the weak force, which is a fine structure constant, which is about 1/30, so it's indeed a lot weaker than the strong force. It's responsible for beta decays, and it's felt by all left-handed particles. Likewise, there's a hypercharge force, which is even weaker. Its fine structure constant is about 1/59. It's closely related to the weak force, and it's felt by all the charged particles. Now, you might wonder about E&M, good old E&M, but it turns out that ordinary E&M is just a combination of the SU2 weak force and the U1 hypercharge force. And this, it's as if you know, you had a can of yellow paint and blue paint, and you mix them together to get green, and the mixing is done by something called the Higgs field. So basically, this is the standard model. Here are the nouns, here are the verbs. I guess the Higgs is some sort of adverb. And that's basically what you've got. But there's lots of reasons to believe in something deeper, because the standard model contains many arbitrary parameters, masses, and mixings, and all this has to be fit to data rather than explained. Also, there are many conceptual questions. Why there are three generations, three kinds of forces, why they have different strengths and ranges. And a fundamental theory should explain these features. We didn't put in the fourth additional force that you all know about called gravity. How do you incorporate the gravitational force, which in this context means how do you quantize gravity? And there's lots of ways to do that, as you all know. And so just as in each previous case, there must still be a deeper underlying principle. So what do we think is going to be true in 20 years? What will the colloquium of describing current theory be like in the future? And it's a very important question because the next generation of accelerators and detectors are really coming online right now. And the most important of these is undoubtedly the LHC at CERN. It's a big underground ring. It has a 27-kilometer beam line with huge, huge detectors. And it's a very impressive thing. So the question is, what do we expect to see? Or in other words, what will high-energy physics be focusing on in the next 10 to 20 years? And over the past 30 years, we've been able to think about this question. And there have been different classes of theories that have been proposed for what might lie beyond the standard model. One popular idea is called supersymmetry, which many of you know about. It's a new kind of symmetry in physics that relates bosons with integer spins to fermions with half-integer spins, or integer plus a half. And then for all the particles we know about, quarks, leptons, and the force mediators, photons, WZs, and gluons, have corresponding superpartners, which are shifted spins by a half. Squarks and sleptons and photinos, linos, xenos, luminos, various new kinds of particles, which are the superpartners of all the known particles that we have. But this is a lot of new particles and a lot of new interactions. And you might wonder why it's worth going through all this trouble. But the purpose is that supersymmetry has a lot of benefits, which is why we do this. One is that it can explain the relative strengths of the forces. It can explain or trigger electroweak symmetry breaking, provide a mechanism to do that. It has various favorable cosmological implications, as do many theories of physics beyond the Standard Model. For example, it may even provide dark matter candidates. And it provides a very clean answer to a very difficult theoretical puzzle in the Standard Model, namely the gauge hierarchy problem, which is the question of why the Higgs particle is so light. But symmetry, supersymmetry, although quite a beautiful theory, is not observed in nature. So that means it's got to be a broken symmetry. And the problem is that supersymmetry is very robust. It's hard to find mechanisms to spontaneously break supersymmetry. And so this leads to an unsolved issue. How do we break SUSY? We currently have to introduce SUSY breaking by hand, and this requires the introduction of many additional unknown parameters. Another idea for physics beyond the Standard Model, much beyond, in fact, they're called guts. And the basic idea here is to try to realize different forces in particles as different faces or aspects of a single gut force in a single gut particle. And the analogy is just like the electric force and magnetic force seem to be very different because they're formed either or felt by static versus moving charges, we know that these are not different forces because we can shift from the rest frame to the moving frame, and then what appears to be electric becomes magnetic, and so electric and magnetic forces are merely different aspects of one force, the electromagnetic force. So the idea is the same true for the strong electroweak and hypercharge forces. Might there be a single strong electroweak hypercharge gut force? This would work better in German, where we wouldn't even have the hyphens, but this is the basic idea. And at first glance, it doesn't seem possible because the forces have different strengths. Remember, the hypercharge force is 1/59th versus 1/30th versus 1/8th. But of course, in quantum field theory, it turns out that the strengths of the forces depends on the energy scale with which we do the experiment to measure them. And again, an analogy is to think of a charge next to a dielectric. So here's a charge, positive charge on a capacitor plate. You bring a dielectric next to it. This pulls a lot of negative charges close to it. And so the dielectric medium partially screens the charge. And so therefore, the effective strength that you feel for the electromagnetic force emanating from this charged plate varies with the distance with which down you probe, because the shorter the distance you go, the higher energy you need in order to probe a shorter distance, but that shorter distance means that you have less screening, and so the force seems stronger. So higher energy corresponds to a stronger force. And so as the energy goes up, 1 over the strength of the force, we physicists usually plot it this way, goes down. Well, this is what happens for a dielectric, but in the supersymmetric Standard Model, the vacuum itself, which has lots of particle and antiparticle creation and annihilation, it's a busy place, and a lot of stuff happens in the vacuum. And it itself essentially behaves like a dielectric, except that the hypercharge and weak forces behave like the dielectric and get stronger, but the strong color force behaves like an anti-dielectric and gets weaker. And the end result is that the strong forces get weaker, the weak forces get stronger, and there turns out to be a unification, which turns out to be a 2 × 10^16 GeV. So this would be the natural energy scale for grand unification. So guts would also have important effects on particle physics. They'd imply new interactions that mix the three forces. They would permit various rare decays of particles, like the proton decay lifetime, which would start to be something very, very long, but indeed the proton would decay. It would explain various charges and interactions of all the fundamental particles. But again, there are many different kinds of guts. What is the larger symmetry group, therefore, that underlies the gut force? Is it SU5 or SO10 or E6 or other groups? You can also ask how the different particles join together under these groups and what kinds of interactions are allowed while respecting these enlarged symmetries. So many questions still remain. So the SUSY idea and the gut idea are very compelling. And certainly their low energy effects, either direct or indirect, as in the case of proton decay for the Levet idea, will indeed be focuses of the experimental high energy physics over the next 20 years. But theorists have a lot to do as well, because we need to build theories in which to interpret the data. Realistic SUSY theories, gut theories, and these aren't the only two ideas for physics beyond the Standard Model. There are many other ideas as well. There are alternative Higgs structures, large extra space type dimensions, strongly coupled Rangel-Sundrum type scenarios. And also, again, we have the question of how to incorporate gravity. So the possibilities are endless, and we still would like guidance from a deeper principle. And of course, what I'm aiming at here is string theory. So you all are pretty familiar with what string theory is, I hope. The basic idea is very simple. Here's just a cartoon. An elementary particle, when looked at under some sort of Planck scale magnifying glass, would really be a vibrating loop of energy, a string. And there are different vibrational modes that a string could have. And these correspond to spin a half particles like quarks and leptons, spin one like the force carriers, or spin two like the graviton. And so gauge interactions, particles, and gravity all in this way would be unified as different excitations of one fundamental entity, the string. That's the basic idea. So the physics of points becomes the physics of strings. And likewise, the physics of one-dimensional world lines becomes the physics of two-dimensional world sheets. These are all just very simple cartoons, but the basic idea is correct. And the physics of Feynman diagrams becomes the physics of manifolds. Now, all these pictures really correspond to closed strings, but strings can also be open, with endpoints ending on membrane-like surfaces of various dimensionalities, and these are called D-brains. And these D-brains can intersect each other in the higher dimensional space and have strings stretching between them. And likewise, the strings and the D-brains can wrap around compactified space-time dimensions, and they result in highly non-trivial geometric configurations, all of which is important because, from my perspective as a phenomenologist, these affect and have direct implications for the allowed excitations of the fundamental strings and brains in the theory, and they dictate the resulting low-energy spectrum of the particles that they predict. Now, this is clearly a whole new geometric language for doing physics, but because string theory includes gravity, its fundamental scale is very high, and it's determined by the Planck scale. And so string theory is ultimately a theory of Planck scale physics. So the standard paradigm that physicists have going beyond the standard model is that we live down here somewhere in the TeV range, in the electroweak symmetry breaking scale over here. And there are three forces which appear distinct. But as we go up higher and higher, well, very soon there'll be a supersymmetric threshold, hopefully, where we would discover weak scale supersymmetry, perhaps at the LHC. And that'll bend the running of the gauge couplings, these fine structure constants, in such a way that there's a unification way out here at 10 to the 16 GeV. That's the gut scale. Gravity, which is extremely weak, so that on the inverse strength of forces plot, it would be way up there. It starts getting stronger and stronger until it becomes of order one here at the Planck scale. And all these things unify together at what's called the string scale, and this is the string theory scale right here. So there's a high energy scale here where fundamental physics is associated. Down here are where current accelerators are, and this range is called the desert. So string theory up here sits at the highest possible energy scale that we can consider, and at the very least, its low energy prediction should be in agreement with the standard model down here, otherwise it's ruled out. And it's also the hope that string theory can provide theoretical guidance concerning the many possible extensions to the standard model, what really happens between here and here. So that's what we're hoping to get out of string theory. And over the past 25 years, string theory really, as many of you know, as all of you know, has come to occupy a central place in high-energy physics. It's had a profound impact in many branches of theoretical physics and mathematics, and led to many new ideas and insights concerning the structure of field theory, gauge theory, supersymmetry, and all their relations to gravity. And it's even been called by some people, here's a person, a piece of 21st century physics that fell by chance into the 20th century. So string theory has had a lot of successes, but the question here is going to be, how many string theories are there? And is the theory even unique? And as Hamlet is supposed to have said, but actually never did, it's a false quote. And therein lies the rub. Because string theory, it turns out, gives rise to a multitude of self-consistent vacua. Each one is called a different string vacuum or a different string model. And it's like having a big master equation with many possible solutions, each with different properties. Roughly speaking, each of these different string vacua corresponds to a different way of compactifying the theory from 10 dimensions, which is its critical dimension, where it naturally lives, down to 4 dimensions, which we observe that are large. And the different vacua, in some sense, correspond to different choices of compactification manifolds, different Wilson lines that get turned on, different vacuum expectation values for unfixed moduli fields, sort of scalar fields that have flat directions, different choices for fluxes that can be turned on in the background geometry, and so forth. Now, the fact that there were so many self-consistent ways of compactifying the theory really was known since the mid-1980s. This is not a surprise. Almost since the beginning when the heterotic string was developed and there was the EA cross E8 and SO32 heterotic strings in 10 dimensions, people knew that there were many, many ways of compactifying this. There were papers starting in 85 and 86 which proposed thousands of different ways to do this. Free fermionic constructions, Calabi-Yau compactifications, orbifold compactifications. But by and large, string theorists didn't worry about this. So here I'm talking a little bit about the sociology. And the reason, I think, there were several reasons. First, these string models usually had flat directions, which means there were no dynamical ways of fixing many of the continuous parameters that could be freely adjusted. Now, flat directions are bad. They're in direct conflict with experiments since they correspond to extra unobserved massless particles and unseen forces. Another reason was that these models were usually supersymmetric, yet the real world is non-supersymmetric, so it wasn't clear really how to break supersymmetry in these models. And then finally, these models were usually formulated in flat space or anti-de Sitter space, and therefore they were also not really very realistic. So it was therefore assumed tacitly that some sort of vacuum selection mechanism would be found eventually, probably relying on some non-perturbative aspects of string theory which weren't understood yet, and that this stabilization mechanism would lead to a unique vacuum that would solve the other problems, break supersymmetry and introduce the de Sitter space. So what changed? What had happened over the past decade, and most recently since 2003, is that there's been increasing realization that this is not what was going to occur. In particular, in the mid-1990s, with what's called the second superstring revolution, we gained considerable insight into the non-perturbative behavior of these theories and discovered that they continue to be self-consistent with these parameters left unfixed, even at strong coupling. So that wasn't going to help. Moreover, in 2003, various proposals, most noticeably what's called KKLT, after its developers, proposed or found a way, proposed a method, a controlled method of stabilizing vacuum, breaking supersymmetry, and realizing de Sitter space in string theory all simultaneously. And the important thing about these methods was that none of these ideas led to a vacuum selection principle. In fact, that what they did show is that a plethora of self-consistent string compactifications is likely to continue to exist even after vacuum stabilization and other problems are solved. So what resulted then is the realization, increasingly dominant perhaps in the string community, or at least growing in the string community or in the string phenomenology community, that string theory really does contain an entire multitude of solutions, in other words, a multitude of stable ground states, without a dynamical or symmetry argument to select amongst them. And such ground states, or such vacua, can be viewed as the local minima in some sort of complex theoretical terrain of hills and valleys. And people usually show pictures like this. And this is what's called the string theory landscape. Now, I object to pictures like this, because this is not what I see outside my office window. The real string theory landscape I'm more familiar with in Arizona looks like that. There are no hills. Instead, we have what are called saguaro cacti. But you can imagine that each of these little poles in the world here is a different string model. And if you go around and count how many of these saguaro you have in the desert, or how many string models there are, and people have done this, what you get is a number that's about 10 to the 500. Now, this is a big number. This is an abuse of scientific notation. Let me emphasize, this is a colloquium, how big 10 to the 500 is. It is bigger than that. It's bigger than that. It's bigger than that and that. This slide dates from the early days of my learning PowerPoint, as you can tell. It's bigger than all of this. It's even bigger than that. It takes that much more. That is 10 to the 500. And if you look at this number, you realize that this is pretty darn big. So you hope, perhaps, this doesn't matter. Unfortunately, it does matter, because the low-energy phenomenology that emerges from the string depends crucially on this particular choice of vacuum state. All the detailed questions you care about, such as the choice of the gauge group, the number of chiral generations, the Suzy breaking scale, the cosmological constant, all depends on the particular vacuum state you select. So how, then, can you hope to make progress in the absence of a vacuum selection principle? Well, one idea floated in 2003, most notably by Mike Douglas, is to examine the landscape statistically, to look for correlations between two different or three different or multiple low-energy phenomenological properties that would otherwise be unrelated in field theory. And therefore, this would be a new method of extracting phenomenological predictions from string theory. So this idea has triggered a surge of activity examining the statistical properties of the landscape. And people have looked at the statistical properties across the landscape of models, which have to do with the Suzy breaking scale, with the cosmological constant, with the ranks of gauge groups, with the prevalence of the standard model gauge group, SU3 cross SU2 cross U1, with the numbers of chiral generations. And many people have been involved in this. And moreover, this line of attack has also led to various paradigm shifts. It has led in particular to alternative notions of naturalness and new cosmological or inflationary scenarios and various anthropic arguments. That's the A word. There are different field theory analogs of the landscape, and various people have been wondering about the boundaries of the landscape, in particular how it relates to or gives way to outside its boundaries something called the swampland. And there are people who even argue, perhaps correctly, that there isn't really a landscape and that this, or that it shouldn't be talked about in this way, and this is what's called land skepticism. So there's been a lot of activity that's developed in just the past few years, and it's even led to something called the String Vacuum Project, which is a large, multi-year, multi-institution, interdisciplinary, these are all words the NSF likes, collaboration to explore the space of string vacua, compactifications, and their low energy implications. And the idea is to do this by enumeration and classification of string vacua, by a detailed analysis of those vacua that look good, that have realistic low energy phenomenologies, and statistical studies across the landscape as a whole. And the idea is that this will involve intensive research at the intersection of particle physics, where people worry about these sorts of topics, and mathematicians who worry about these sorts of relevant topics, and computer scientists who worry about these sorts of relevant topics. So this is a big idea for a large collaboration called the String Vacuum Project. The particle physicists involved in this in the US are listed here, some of them. And there's a wiki, which you can look at. And there's a corresponding group of people who are also involved in this simultaneously in Europe, led by Fernando Quevedo. And there are a number of people involved in that, and they have as well a website. So this is good that there's a lot of progress, but unfortunately, although there have been many abstract theoretical discussions of string vacua and their statistical properties, there have been very few direct statistical examinations of actual string vacua. And in spite of recent progress, this is because the construction and analysis of actual string vacua remains a fairly complicated affair. And most of the effort over the past few years has focused in this direction on the landscape of open strings, so-called type 1 strings. So one of the things I've been doing over the past few years has been to perform what really turned out to be the first ever statistical studies of the heterotic landscape, the landscape of closed strings. And I think this is interesting because heterotic models or closed string models are fundamentally different from type 1 models. They have tighter constraints coming from things like modular invariance. Their gauge groups are generated differently as so-called affine Lie algebras or Ketz-Mudi algebras. And they have a maximal rank, which is very much fixed. And they have completely different phenomenologies. In fact, the way the gauge coupling unification comes out in those models is very different from the way it comes out or doesn't come out in type 1 models. And so one could expect potentially different statistical properties and correlations. And this could even provide useful guides for heterotic model builders. So what I'd like to do is just sort of give you a rough idea of how one does this. And I'll give you an idea of how we do this on the heterotic side. But analogous things exist also on the type 1 side. The first step is to write some sort of big computer program which can generate models randomly. And we have one which we call KLT for Kawhi, Llewellyn, and Tai, which is the formalism we use for generating heterotic models. And the basic idea is to put in some idea of what kinds of models we'd like how much supersymmetry we would like these to have. We put in some random number generator seed, and we tell it how long we want it to run, and out pop potential models. So this kind of block looks like a potential model. And it basically tells us about phases and boundary conditions and GSO projections, all digitized for right-moving fields and left-moving fields and phases for partition functions. And each of these is a potential model. And we can generate millions or billions of self-consistent configurations of these sorts of things very easily. The next step, then, is to take one of those proto-models and analyze it. So what we do is we basically enumerate all the states in the Fock space which satisfy all the constraints we need to have. And we try to organize them into meaningful representations. So the first thing we do is we find the gravitinos in the theory and thereby determine how much supersymmetry we have. And then we identify and analyze the gauge bosons, and in that way we determine the gauge group, like SU3 cross SU2 cross U1 or some bigger gut group. And then we look at all the other states. We classify them by their charges under the gauge group and suitable Suzy multiplets. And in that way, we fill out a spectrum. And we get an output, which looks like that. And basically, it just tells us about all the different particles and their Dynkin indices and their representations. And we know exactly what we've got. And so this tells us basically what our models are like. And so what do we find? So we have many papers on this. These are papers I've written in collaboration with Mike Lenick and David Seneschal and Vipath Wozniak. These are all my students. Well, Lenick and Wozniak are my students. Seneschal is a former grad student. When I was a graduate student at Cornell back in the late 80s, so was David Seneschal. And so it's interesting how sometimes make friends with the current people in your group because you might come back and work with them later on, years later. And so we've put out a series of papers, and I'll just give you two or three little smattering slides of the kinds of things one can do. So, for example, across all the string models in our samples, we can examine how many of them contain SU3 factors, or SU2 factors, or U1 factors. Likewise, across all different gauge groups that come out in our samples, we can ask how many of them contain SU3s, SU2, or U1 factors. And therefore, we can observe things like, for example, although SU3 factors appear in 24% of gauge groups, these groups emerge from actual string models in our sample only half as frequently as you would have expected. So there are certain kinds of tendencies that string theory gives you. Here's one. So it sounds like an Ivory Soap commercial. 99.81% of all heterotic string models in our sample, which contain one or more SUN factors, also contain an equal or greater number of U1 factors. This is an interesting correlation between the presence of SUN and U1, which you wouldn't have expected in field theory. These things could have been independent, but in string theory, they seem to be correlated. This is not true for SL groups, only for SU groups. And there are various other kinds of things. You can ask, how likely are SU3, SU2, and U1 to appear simultaneously in a given string model? And you find that it's pretty rare. The probability for this to happen only begins to grow once you've implemented so many orbifold twists that you've broken your gauge group down to at least 10 different gauge group factors. So in other words, you're not likely to have the standard model cross a big group all by itself. It's more likely to have the standard model cross a lot of little groups all tensored together. So these kinds of things agree with all known semi-realistic string models in the literature, and they provide limits on the possible hidden sector gauge groups for such models. And this would be a useful guide for future string model building. If you want to realize the standard model, you know you have to implement a lot of different orbifold twists. But these are just statistical sorts of results. In fact, averaged over all degrees of how well the gauge group is shattered, turns out the total probability of obtaining the standard model in this sample is only about 10%. Which is similar to what's found for type 1 strings. So we get a sense of how likely the standard model is to come out of string theory. You could ask about cross-correlations between all possible gauge groups of interest. For example, what are the joint probabilities that two different gauge group factors will appear in the same string model simultaneously? This is a kind of question you want to know if one factor is going to be observable and the other factor is going to be, say, hidden. So you can get a correlation probability table. So if you want to know the probability that you get a group theory a low energy gauge group in your string model, which has both an SU10 and, say, an SU5 factor, okay, so SU5 cross SO10, these are the probabilities. And you learn various things from this. For example, you learn that the Patisse-Salam unification, which is a form of gut unification, which involves one certain group, is much more likely than the standard model itself, while SO10 is somewhat more prevalent and SU5 is somewhat less prevalent than the standard model. So you get guidance or some sort of statistical ideas about what kinds of gut groups exist beyond the standard model. Another important quantity which string theory is in a unique position to predict or calculate is the cosmological constant. So you could ask, what kinds of values of the cosmological constant do you get in our sample? And we find a histogram. Looks like this. You'll notice it peaks near zero, which is very good, especially since the units here are Planck scale. So it ought to be near zero. And both positive and negative values do emerge, but 73% of them are positive of this quantity, which means negative actual cosmological constant, which means ADS. So we already see that there's a bias against De Sitter. And we also see something very interesting. We looked at, in this case, about 10 to the 5 models, but the smallest value of the cosmological constant is not 10 to the minus 5, as Busol-Polchinski in some scenarios might have suggested, but really quite a bit bigger. And you can ask why this happens, and it turns out that the reason this is happening is that there's a great redundancy in values of lambda. In particular, you would have expected that every time you have a new string model, it leads to a new value of the cosmological constant. So the number of distinct models that you look at would be the number of distinct values of the cosmological constant you would expect, and it would be a 1-to-1, a 45-degree line. And instead, what you find is that this is not the case. It's highly suppressed. The number of values of cosmological constant found is significantly less than the number of models examined. And the reason for this is that unrelated models with completely different gauge groups and particle contents can nevertheless have identical values of the cosmological constant. This is because of string symmetries that exist that transcend anything you would expect in field theory. So again, we're learning things about string theory. In fact, it appears that the number of cosmological constant values that are even permissible in string theory may actually saturate. You could fit that kind of curve to an exponential form and you get some numbers. I don't know if we really feel that we've examined enough models to observe this saturation reliably, but again, this gives you the idea of the kinds of things people are doing. You could ask if there are correlations between gauge groups and cosmological constants. Wouldn't expect that in field theory, But in string theory, it turns out that there are very profound correlations. For example, as the number of gauge group factors increases, in other words, as you do more and more orbital twists to break things down, it turns out that your average cosmological constant decreases very sharply following a very precise functional form. Again, these are just statistical averages, but they imply that more twists, in other words, smaller gauge group factors, leads to smaller one-loop cosmological constants. OK, you could ask about the probabilities for different signs of the cosmological constant as a function of the number of different gauge group factors. Start small, grows. OK. But there are various issues that come up when you do these things, new kinds of statistical problems that you have to face that you didn't have to face before. For example, one is something called the problem of floating correlations. And the basic idea here turns out that this was never discussed previously, but it turns out to play a huge role in obtaining meaningful statistical results from a data set to which you have only limited computational access, which is what the landscape is giving you. And the problem of floating correlations is the observation that some statistical correlations are unstable. They float or evolve as the sample size increases. And the reason why this happens is really very simple. Essentially, as you continue to randomly generate models, it gets harder and harder to find a new model you didn't see before. It's like fishing. You throw in your hook into the pond, and out comes a fish. And it's a new fish, so you throw it in the boat. But then you keep, or let's say you record its data, you throw it back. You keep fishing again, and out comes very often the same fish you saw before. Because some fish are really big, and you keep hitting them, the big whale. You keep hitting it again and again. And little fish that are hard to find, maybe under the whale, you don't see very often. So it gets harder and harder to find new distinct models that you didn't see before. And therefore, physical characteristics which were originally rare are often forced to become less rare as your sample size increases and as you probe more deeply into the space of models. Because the only time you can record late in your search that you have found a new model is when it's a model you didn't see before because it was rare. So the only new models after a certain point are the rare ones. And therefore, the probability of being rare is increasing as you go further and further into penetrating the space of models. And the reason this is happening is because not all string models are equally likely to be found. Because really, you're not searching the space of models. You're really using some sort of model construction technique which specifies models according to some set of internal parameters. You're scanning over fluxes or orbifold twists or boundary condition phases or Wilson lines. You're varying various parameters. And there's a mapping which is one-to-one between each parameter choice and a model in the model space. But many different parameter choices give rise to exactly the same model. So some models are very likely to be found. These are the whales, the big ones, the easy ones to find. Some are moderately likely to be found, and some are very hard to be found. And therefore, some models are much more likely to be generated than others. And this feature is essentially unavoidable. So you don't see the model space directly. This is what you're trying to look at, where each model has an equal probability of being looked at. Instead, what you see is a deformed version of it, a so-called probability space. And it can be very different. And this can be very damaging. You might wonder if this difference really matters for statistical correlations between physical observables. But it does if the physical properties, for example, the colors of these boxes, are somehow correlated with the deformations associated with these probabilities. I'll give you a real-world example. It's the difference between this. Now, this is not 2008, luckily. This was the good old 2000, which I've never gotten over. And this, which is a cartogram based on population, where each state is rescaled according to its population size. So notice what happened to California, for example. Or even this, which is a cartogram based on population density. This is Washington, D.C. You'll notice the difference here, very red, very blue. So what this means is that these sorts of deformations do matter and can affect outcomes. If you're looking at which color is dominant, here you'd say it's blue, here you'd say it's red. It depends on how you're measuring the probabilities. So these sorts of deformations do matter and can affect outcomes. And so we had to develop various ways of getting past these sorts of issues. And so we need to develop methods of extracting information, even if it's only limited information, about the full landscape on the basis of only this sort of partial distorted information. And I like to feel that this whole field is at the beginning, just as analogous to when lattice gauge theory must have been a very new field. This is computational quantum field theory where you put, where you discretize time, where you discretize space-time, you make a lattice for space-time on the computer, and you numerically simulate correlation functions. And this is called lattice gauge theory. And again, analogously, the question is, how do you extract information about the continuum limit when you take the lattice spacing to zero size on the basis of calculations done at finite lattice spacing? And lattice gauge theorists have spent many, many years developing statistical techniques to do this. And likewise, we in the string vacuum project are going to need to develop analogous statistical techniques for our problem. And indeed, there are solutions we've developed. And I don't want to go into these, but there are basically statistical methods which one can show actually give rise to various sorts of various sorts of solutions. For example, there are various cases where certain curves ought to lie on top of each other, but because of distortions, it turns out that they don't. And using statistical techniques, it turns out that one can get them to do that very quickly. And so there need to be ways that are developed, and that's what people have done. Okay, I'm skipping over these details. I'm happy to talk to people privately, but I want to get to the whole thing. There's also another possible complication that occurs when you try to look at a landscape as a whole. For example, all of the previous assumptions assume that the low energy limit of a given string model has a relatively simple field theory structure, a single vacuum, namely the ground state, and a tower of excited states built on that vacuum. As such, the resulting phenomenology associated with that string model is uniquely determined, and each string model corresponds to a unique possible ground state for the universe. So one string model corresponds to one vacuum, and counting models is comparable to counting vacua. But in recent years, there's been an increasing recognition that many models also contain metastable additional vacua whose lifetimes can greatly exceed cosmological timescales. This is the work most recently popularized by Introligator Seiberg and Shi, but really the idea of this goes back even further than that. And the idea basically is that somehow in the space of models, here these are supersymmetric models and we're plotting scalar potentials, but the basic idea is general, there's not only a true ground state somewhere in here, but a metastable state there. And to float from the metastable point to the true supersymmetric one, the ground state, requires that there be some sort of potential here which looks like this with a hump. And the lifetime for decaying directly from here to here might be large enough to be larger than the time, the age of the universe. And so there are really functionally, for all intents and purposes, two vacua, two possible ground states in such a theory. And the importance of this is great because the phenomenological properties of the metastable vacuum can be completely different from those of the true ground state. For example, this one, the metastable one, breaks supersymmetry, whereas here, this true stable one preserves supersymmetry. Same is true for other symmetries like R symmetries. They can have, this vacuum can have a completely different gauge group than this one does, and so forth. They're really different theories. As a result, the one-to-one connection between models and vacua need not apply, and the full landscape of string theory can be even richer than you previously imagined, since all long-lived metastable vacua really need to be included in the analysis. In fact, this effect can be extremely dramatic and completely alter your perspective on what kinds of physics might dominate the landscape. Because here's an example. Many string vacua turn out to take the form of something called flux compactification. And these theories have so-called deconstructed low-energy versions, which correspond to supersymmetric abelian gauge theories with very specific particle contents. This is just for the experts. But I just want to show that there's a very simple sort of kind of theory that one expects to be the low-energy limit of a certain class of string theories that are very popular. Why is this important? Well, in collaboration with my postdoc in Arizona, we just showed recently that in the presence of kinetic mixing, it's become that we've been able to show that these theories give rise to not just one extra metastable vacuum or two, but infinite towers of metastable vacua with higher and higher energies. In fact, we can actually plot the form of this. This is work done with Brooks Thomas in Arizona. And you see that there's an infinite number of metastable vacua as you get lower and lower. As the number of vacua grows towards infinity, the energy of the highest vacuum remains fixed, while the energy of the true ground state tends towards zero. You keep sliding in an additional vacuum below and below and below, but always above zero. So you're getting closer and closer to a supersymmetric limit, but never really hitting it. Therefore, even though such models might be relatively rare across the landscape, and they're not believed to be so, but even if they were relatively rare, the fact that they give rise to infinitely many vacua means that they could completely dominate the properties of the landscape as a whole. Okay. The existence of the landscape also allows you to reformulate many of our usual theoretical notions in unimaginable ways, but have been conceived to be unimaginable before. For example, let's ask a simple question. is supersymmetry natural? That's a very important question, because most theoretical frameworks for physics beyond the Standard Model involve the introduction of supersymmetry in some form. There are various reasons for this, as we've enumerated before. And so supersymmetry is truly ubiquitous in our theories, on the archive, in the colloquium presentations you're likely to hear, indeed everywhere except the data. So you'd think supersymmetry is natural, but lots of competing theories have recently appeared over the past decade. Large extra dimensions, small extra dimensions, strongly coupled theories. And these theories have grown more and more complex. Nowadays, you go to a Beyond the Standard Model conference, those of you that do, and somebody gets up and begins his talk as follows. Well, we are made of open strings, and we live on a brain, and the brain lives in extra dimensions, and the brain is wrapped and intersects other brains, and the extra dimensions are warped, and the warping is severe and forms the throat, and the brain is falling into the throat. And this is cutting-edge model building, folks. But to some, it may sound like a lot to swallow, pardon the pun about falling into the throat. So this may sound highly unnatural, but is supersymmetry itself truly natural? What does it mean to be natural anyway? There are lots of different notions of naturalness. There's effective field theory Dirac naturalness. An effective field theory is natural if the dimensionless coefficients of all operators are of order 1. No unnaturally small numbers. For example, with this criteria, the gauge hierarchy is unnatural, which is the biggest motivation for supersymmetry in the first place. Or you could say there's something called Tuft naturalness. Even if a number is small, it can be natural if it's protected by a symmetry. But neither of these addresses the question of whether a theory, even if it's natural in the above sense, is likely to be right. How likely is supersymmetry to be the correct theory? Likely? This is a crazy word. We always judge theories this way when we're in our private mind or when we're over beer somewhere. But we don't say it aloud, well, I just did, and it's being recorded, I'm told, because the question seems more philosophical than scientific. How likely relative to what? All the other theories you can imagine, and who's doing the imagining? Me, Ed Witten, Stephen Harper? All right, for those of you visiting, I've learned that Stephen Harper is, or may be, the prime minister of this country. I'm pleased to see that the constitutional crises that were going on in the early 90s when I was a postdoc at McGill have continued in this country. So who's doing the imagining? This question doesn't seem to be very scientific. How can you compare the likelihood of one theory against another? Well, string theory, as you know, as I just said, provides a framework in which this question can be addressed in a meaningful way because of the landscape. So you can now formulate the question scientifically. In the landscape of all possible string solutions, how many of these solutions are supersymmetric? Is Susie natural on this landscape or relatively rare? Okay, well, we actually looked at this question using these kinds of techniques, supersymmetric, these sorts of statistical techniques, and we found the following results. Most string models, at least for heterotic cases, are non-supersymmetric. And very few of them have even just one supersymmetry, and much, much fewer of them, these are percentages, by the way, so this is very far down, have extended supersymmetries. Conclusion, nearly half of the heterotic landscape is non-supersymmetric but tachyon-free. The Susy portion of the heterotic landscape is just 1/4, even at the string scale, and models exhibiting extended Susys are much more rare than that. In fact, the supersymmetric fraction of the full landscape may be even smaller, because the free field constructions we're looking at probably tend to favor models with unbroken Susy. And even when stabilized models exhibit Susy at the string scale, it's statistically unlikely that supersymmetry will survive down to the weak scale, which is what we're talking about. So therefore, weak scale supersymmetry is rather unnatural from a string landscape perspective. Not a problem. You might even consider it good news, because it means we'll actually learn something about string theory and its preferred compactifications, if weak-scale Susy is actually discovered in upcoming collider experiments. OK, you can also ask whether there are relations between supersymmetry amounts and gauge groups. And here is a relationship between, given a different gauge group, what are the probabilities, or rather, given whether you have supersymmetry or not, what is the likelihood of having different gauge groups? And we see that there are very dramatic correlations. Gauge groups with larger ranks are favored more strongly with Susy than without supersymmetry. And then you could ask the inverse question. If you know the gauge group, how likely are different degrees of supersymmetry? How predictive is it? So if you know the gauge group, suppose you know that there's an SU3, how likely is it that there will be these levels of supersymmetry? And what you find is that the Standard Model prefers to remain non-supersymmetric, absolutely. GUTS, on the other hand, have a greater preference for Susy than does the Standard Model alone. Exceptional groups almost require supersymmetry. And therefore, strings favor either non-supersymmetric Standard Model or Susy GUTS. In other words, no GUT, no supersymmetry, or with GUT, with supersymmetry. but not the MSSM, which is no gut with supersymmetry. So you learn things like this. And the list goes on. You could look at lots of other things, chirality, numbers of generations, and so forth. You could keep going. There's no end to the statistics you can statistical games you can play. Okay. Needless to say, however, the existence of the landscape prompts a number of questions of a much more philosophical nature. So I want to get into the philosophy here. You could ask, given the existence of the landscape, to what extent is string theory predictive? This goes to the heart of what it means to be doing science. This is the most fundamental question you could ask. Now, well, you might say, well, predictivity is not an absolute necessity for all aspects of science, but science often begins with observation and classification, which is what you need to do for the landscape. But you could answer, well, yeah, but observers and experimentalists need not be primarily concerned with making predictions, but theorists have to be. Theories have to incorporate the ability not only to explain, but also to predict. Okay, you could come back with and say, this is my Sagredo Salviati here. But the most direct experimental consequences of string theory are going to lie at inaccessible energy scales. Is it fair then to hold string theory to normal standards of predictivity? Well, yes, because even though many of the direct consequences of string theory lie at presently inaccessible energy scales, not all will be. And even if all of the firm experimental consequences of string theory were somehow proven to lie at scales very far beyond current accelerated technology, this itself would not free string theory from its obligations to make predictions which are testable at those higher energy scales. In other words, testable in principle, but not in practice. Okay, but here's an objection. String theory is not a model like the standard model. Really, you should think of it as a language like quantum field theory itself, within which the subsequent act of model building takes place. Quantum field theory doesn't make predictions on its own. Why hold string theory to such a standard? But then you can answer that too, because this really misses a critical point. While quantum field theory tolerates many free parameters, string theory doesn't. Generally, all free parameters in string theory, gauge couplings, or Kyle couplings, et cetera, are determined by the VEVs of scalar fields, and they're expected to have dynamical origins within the theory itself. String theory should determine its own parameters. In other words, string theory really is sort of not just a language, it's also a model in that language. It's a little bit different than quantum field theory. So given the existence of the landscape, it's certainly not too much to ask that string theory give rise to predictions which, although not maybe involving individual quantities such as the number of generations, but about correlations. It should manifest its predictive power through the existence of correlations between physical observables that would otherwise be uncorrelated in quantum field theory. And therefore, such correlations would be the space-time phenomenological manifestations of the deeper geometric structure that ultimately underlines string theory and distinguishes it from a theory based on point particles. So the question concerning the predictivity of string theory boils down to a single question. To what extent are there correlations between physical observables across the string theory landscape as a whole? So you would say, well, if there are correlations, your theory is predictive. And if there aren't any, you would say it's not predictive. But unfortunately, the true picture is likely to be much more complicated and lies somewhere between those two extremes, because it's most likely that different regions of the landscape exhibit different correlations. Such regions may have different sizes, and moreover, they're likely to exhibit non-trivial overlaps. Here's a region one, here's a region two, here's a region three. Let's look at this little picture just to give an idea. So here's that picture again. So you get very non-trivial patterns of correlations. Because let's suppose that each region exhibits a correlation between only two physical observables. So region one has a correlation between X and Y. That's it. Region two has a correlation between Y and Z. That's it. Region three has a correlation between W and Z. Well, that alone implies that the overlaps are going to be very non-trivial. Regions 1 and 2 have an overlap, which is a single 3-quantity correlation between x, y, and z. Regions 2 and 3 also have a single 3-quantity correlation. This is between y, z, and w. But regions 1 and 3 now are not going to have a single 3-quantity correlation, but two different 2-quantity correlations, which are disconnected, x and y and w and z. And the total intersection region here has a single 4-quantity correlation between all four of them. So there's going to be a very complex structure. So you can ask, how then would you proceed? You need to develop practical statistical methods of probing such a non-trivial correlation structure experimentally through the random generation analysis of string models drawn across the landscape as a whole. And in this way, you hope to develop and quantify a practical notion of predictivity for such a system. Okay, so this has been done. This is work in collaboration with my former student, Mike Lennick, and we developed various mathematical methods of doing this, which I won't get into. Okay, final topic. Thus far, we've treated the landscape in a rather simplistic manner. We've assumed there are many possible states, as I've shown you, and the universe chooses one. But of course, from a quantum cosmological standpoint, it's much more likely that all possibilities are realized and that our universe is only one bubble in such a larger multiverse or megaverse. In accordance with the string landscape, each universe in the multiverse would have its own physical laws and its own constants of nature realized somewhere. So, welcome to the multiverse. And if this is true, then our own universe is not special at all, and there would be many other parallel universes whose properties need not resemble those of our own universe in any way. And one could further imagine, therefore, that these different universes are continually being spawned in a process dubbed eternal inflation, first proposed in a more general context more than a quarter of a century ago by Andre Linde and others. So if these ideas are correct, entirely new sets of questions respond as well. How many universes are there? How are they generated? Through vacuum decay and tunneling, or in the interiors of black holes? And there are people here who are actively involved in these questions. Are all possible universes created equal? How did we land in this universe? Are the fundamental laws of physics as we know them destined to become nothing more than environmental accidents of initial conditions that happen to lead us to being in this universe as opposed to any other? Are quantities such as, let's say, the electron-proton mass ratio now going to be viewed as having no deep theoretical underpinnings, but instead like the planetary orbital radii, just valid by accident in this universe? Are we giving up on being able to calculate such things? Is theoretical particle physics destined to become a branch of cosmology now about initial conditions of how we landed in this universe within a larger multiverse? And the biggest question of them all, why are we here? Is there anything special about our own universe whatsoever? Any tool that remains by which we could hope to develop insight into our universe and make predictions? There are lots of theories about this. Here's one. Do you know why the universe works so well? God runs it like a business. That's why. That's the capitalist solution. But there are other ideas, and one of them is called the anthropic principle. Now, this is a very weird notion because people either love it or hate it, and people aren't even sure what they're talking about when they mention it. Because there are many different versions of the anthropic principle which run from the silly to the not so silly. Here's the silly. The universe takes, in my opinion, the universe takes the form that it does so as to allow observers to observe it. My verdict on this is silly. The universe doesn't care about me or you, and it doesn't exhibit narcissistic or exhibitionist tendencies that make it want to be observed. That's not anthropic, that's anthropomorphic. But okay, here, maybe it's not so silly. Here's the Star Trek version. Here's a pop quiz. The Enterprise enters an uncharted solar system with 10 to the 500 planets. In order to survey the planets quickly, Kirk sends a landing party down to each planet simultaneously. After an hour, he puts out a general call for survey reports to be sent back to the ship. Question: what percentage of surveys will report an M-type planet capable of supporting life? What do you think?
All.
100%, because all other teams will be dead and won't be able to file any reports. Don't laugh. Certain outcomes about the universe are guaranteed because otherwise we couldn't have even asked the question. So this form of the anthropic principle has had some successes, most notably the prediction of a non-zero cosmological constant of the right size. This is Weinberg's argument, which I can go through. But the point is that if the universe is real, the only hope we may have for understanding the properties of our own universe is through these sorts of applications of the anthropic principle. But there's also fierce opposition to this idea. Some people say this is not the way science should be done. The anthropic principle represents a surrendering, they claim, of the idea that the fundamental laws of physics are unique and not tuned for particular outcomes, especially not an outcome such as life. Or, as Bert Richter has argued, the anthropic principle is not an explanation, it's an observation, which is a different thing. In science, we normally accept various priors and we seek to use those to derive new results. For example, but these are the questions then that come up. Is it fair to use our own existence as such a prior, as such an input? How do we decide which input data are acceptable and which data isn't? And what's the data? Intelligent civilizations or life in general? Or what kinds of life can we imagine? Are universes which are capable of supporting life somehow preferred in a Darwinian sense over those that don't? Obviously, there's no easy answers to these questions, just some sort of raging debate. It is another critical question. How can we test these ideas? Are they even falsifiable? All right, here's Lenny again. Throughout my long experience as a scientist, I've heard unfalsifiability hurled at so many important ideas that I'm inclined to think that no idea can have great merit unless it has drawn this criticism. I'll give some examples. He's easy to quote. In the early days of the quark theory, its many opponents dismissed it as unfalsifiable. Quarks are permanently bound together into protons. They can never be separated and examined individually. They are, so to speak, hidden behind a veil. But by now, although no single quark has ever been seen, there's no one who doubts the correctness of that theory. Another example is Goof's inflationary theory. In 1980, it seemed impossible to look back into the inflationary era and see direct evidence for the phenomenon. Another impenetrable veil called the surface of last scattering prevented any observation of the inflationary process. Or, he gives a third example. I can imagine the partisans of Lamarck criticizing Darwin. Your theory is unfalsifiable, Charles. You can't go backwards in time through the millions of years over which natural selection acted. All you'll ever have is circumstantial evidence and an unfalsifiable hypothesis. By contrast, our Lamarckian theory is scientific because it's falsifiable. All we have to do is create a population that lifts weights in the gym every day for a few hours. After a few generations, their children's muscles will bulge at birth. He continues, good scientific methodology is not an abstract set of rules dictated by philosophers. It's conditioned by and determined by the science itself and the scientists who create the science. What may have constituted scientific proof for a particle physicist of the 1960s, namely the detection of an isolated particle, is inappropriate for a modern quark physicist who can never hope to remove an isolated quark. Let's not put the cart before the horse. Science is the horse that pulls the cart of philosophy. In each case that I describe, quarks, inflation, Darwinian, the accusers were making the mistake of underestimating human ingenuity. It took only a few years to indirectly test the quark theory with great precision. It took 20 years to do the experiments that confirmed inflation. It took 100 years for Darwin. What people usually mean when they make the accusation of unfalsifiability is that they themselves don't have the imagination to figure out how to test the idea. So he ends, will it be possible to test internal inflation in the landscape? I certainly think so, this is Lenny. Although it may be, as in the case of quarks, that the test will be less direct and involve more theory than some would like. There are some ideas that people have proposed. Some are possible only in principle. For example, in the long distance future, if when our horizon expands sufficiently, or if when the universe tunnels into another vacuum state, you'd notice that. Or the signature is at or near a domain wall. But others are potentially more realistic. For example, traces of stringy physics or inflationary history imprinted on the CMB, or evidence for strings through deviations from general relativity, or direct observation of string theory at the LHC, which is possible if the string scale is low, or the observation, this would really do it, the observation of spatial variation of the fundamental constants. But these issues are far from settled. Lee, I'm going to quote you. I'm very glad that Susskind has been able to give these issues much more visibility, but it would be a very unfortunate if string theorists finally accept that there is an issue with predictivity, only to fall for the easy temptation of adopting a strategy towards it that it cannot yield falsifiable theories. The problem with non-falsifiable theories is nothing other than that they cannot be proven wrong. If a large body of our colleagues feels comfortable believing a theory that cannot be proved wrong, then the progress of science could get stuck, leading to a situation in which false but unfalsifiable theories dominate the attention of our field. Later, you'll explain to me what it means to be false but unfalsifiable. But we'll go on. Finally, why go through all this worry? Even if the multiverse exists, why not just focus on our own universe, the so-called fertile patch? This is what a lot of people are arguing. Well, why climb Pythagoras? Because it's there. No, more seriously, if there's really 10 to the 500 vacua, it's very unlikely that we will be able to know which one is our universe exactly. Many will satisfy current experimental constraints, so our need to make predictions still requires that we understand something of the more global structure. A better explanation due to Schellekens, is that we still want to answer the why questions of the standard model. Why three generations? Why three types of non-gravitational forces? If the standard model is part of a huge ensemble, he writes, then the only way to answer such questions is to understand the distribution of that ensemble. We have to care about more than just our own universe, and it's inevitable that anthropic arguments will play such a role in addressing such questions. So let me just jump to a conclusion. Clearly, as far as statistical work goes, there's a lot of things that need to be done, and people are working on those, and the String Vacuum Project will be tackling a lot of those questions. But there are certain dangers. The lamppost effect, the danger of restricting one's attention to those portions of the landscape you have control over. The Gödel effect, namely that the landscape is so large that it's possible that no matter how many input priors one demands, there will always be another observable which cannot be uniquely predicted. What I'll call the bullseye effect, the possibility that we don't always know what the target is, since we're not certain how our low-energy world embeds into the fundamental theory. Supersymmetry, guts, technicolor, what? But I think there are certain reasons we should continue to do such statistical analyses, and I think that they can play a role. Let me then end with where this left us. Remember I began with this quote about this big debate that people are in denial about these facts, but the theory is going to win, and physicists who are trying to deny what's going on are going to lose. Well, here were reactions to Lenny. Paul Steinhardt writes, I love Lenny, but I hate this recent landscape idea, and I hope it will go away. To which Lenny responds, I want to thank Paul Steinhardt for his concise summary of the views on the other side of this debate. That's Lenny. Here's Tuft. When I hear Lenny say that this theory is going to win and physicists are trying to deny it, what's going on are going to lose, then to my opinion, he's going too far. This is not the way physics has worked for us in the past, and it's not too late to hope that we will be able to find better arguments in the future. Well, Lenny writes, this is hard to argue with. I consider myself to be a cautious, rather conservative physicist. I really don't like new ideas, but I also find wisdom in a quote from Sherlock Holmes. When you've eliminated all that is impossible, whatever remains must be the truth, no matter how improbable it is. Giddings writes, I feel the views of some that such a picture is unscientific, or a cop-out, are extreme. In particular, understanding the laws that give rise to the megaverse is a very scientific question, and one that I think is well worth studying further. Here's Shulkin's. Finally, after 15 years, the debate that should have started around the mid-1980s, but it was stifled by an irrational opposition against the notion that our observation of the Standard Model could be biased by our own existence. To me, at least, one thing seems absolutely obvious. The idea that the Standard Model is even approximately unique will eventually find its place in history next to Kepler's attempt to compute the orbits in the solar system. Understandable at its time, but terribly anthropocentric. And the final quote I want to leave you with is this one from Gino Segre. We now believe that we live on an ordinary planet, one of many, circling an ordinary star, one of many, in an ordinary galaxy, one of many. This far we've come, through Copernicus on down. Perhaps we need to take the next step, admittedly a revolutionary one, of saying that we live in an ordinary universe, one of many, a very small part of an enormous megaverse. So there you go. Thank you very much.
Questions?
Just a question about what you expect to get out of a statistical analysis. Suppose you found that there was one sort of theory that was extremely improbable amongst all.
I would call that natural.
Or suppose you found that there was only one theory that of all the thousands of others that you looked at, millions of. It was only one theory that had the properties you wanted. Would you say is ours? Which would you want to see? Which would you associate?
I would not like to think that we're in a very fine-tuned state, because then you have to ask, why did that happen? So if there was just one theory there that was ours and everything else in this vast sea was different, then you'd wonder what dynamics landed us there. You'd be back to the original question. But it would be very satisfying, because that's the style of believing in a uniqueness, again, only a different kind of uniqueness. But maybe that's not it. We don't think the solar system is unique anymore. We don't try to predict the planets' radii. I mean, we've given up on that. We've moved those numbers about the natural world from the theory should explain to the theory not explain column, and we don't try. Maybe the electron mass needs to go from the theory should explain to the theory you should not bother to explain category. And that's, I think, what this paradigm shift is about. But then you can rightly ask, what numbers are left? What do we try to predict? Just some people have said that it has to do with whether the numbers are dimension full or dimensionless. Maybe some are determined by the landscape, maybe the dimension full numbers, and the dimensionless numbers are pure numbers, but maybe not. I'm not trying to suggest answers. I'm trying to suggest the nature of the controversy and the paradigm shift.
So you talked about possible biases in your way of sampling the landscape.
Oh, yeah.
And you compared it with lattice gauge theory.
It seems to me
there's an essential difference, which is really what this question is getting to. In the case of lattice gauge theory, you know the probability distribution you're trying to sample,
given
by the Boltzmann lens. In this case, how do we know?
You don't.
Could your sampling method be the one that nature uses?
Is it
a uniform distribution over all landscapes?
This is called,
There's a big uncertainty here, but without resolving that, how do you know what these statistics mean?
Yes, this is called the measure problem. What is the measure on the landscape?
Is it dynamically determined?
That's right.
If so, by what?
Exactly. So I agree completely. We don't have a measure on the landscape. That's why these issues come up. But I'm assuming that one would like to count one model per. But the whole issue about vacua, that there could be multiple vacua per model, is really a measure question. Are we counting models, string vacua, or are we counting vacua that are ground states of the theory, even if many of them exist in the low energy limit of the same string model? Again, it's a measure problem. Yes, no answer. But we're going to have to think about this. That's all my point is. I agree.
Why is the specific number 10 to the power of 500? I understand that Yao and other mathematicians have not been able to prove that there's a finite number of Calabi-Yao factorizations.
Right, actually.
Could be infinite.
Okay, but believe it or not, many of these flux compactifications are beyond the class of Calabi-Yau. They're not Calabi-Yau compactifications. They're extensions where you turn on fluxes and deform the geometry even away from Calabi-Yau. So, and Calabi-Yau were only the compactifications you wanted to consider even in the old days when you were looking for low energy supersymmetry. Who needs that, maybe? Right, we have no evidence for that too. So it's broader than just that. Many people, there have been some papers by Taylor and Douglas, Waddy Taylor and Mike Douglas, which have talked about the finiteness or non-finiteness of the landscape, at least within the framework of flux compactifications. But yeah.
Yeah, Sam?
So you talked about correlations in the landscape. And so what exactly did you expect? Some kind of correlation between the couplings and the gauge groups? Because we have only one universe, and even if you find some correlation...
Well, we don't know that we have one.
No, but we have one that we can
observe.
We have. So the thing is that... Well, I see one. I don't know.
If I stop, you have one.
How high you are. You might see other way. But the point is that you have only one point. So yeah. There's no sense of making correlations, to compare correlations with observables. So, you can just say this universe.
Right. But the point is, you want to look for something that string theory is adding into the game, that it is predictive, that it is telling.
It's not a prediction.
Well, it is. Because if string theory is able to tell you every time A happens, B happens, then you test, you look at your one universe and say, well, A happened. Did B happen, yes or not? If so, then you believe more about the correctness of your theory. If not, then it's falsified.
No, but then I can say
that requires a mathematical correlation, a statistical correlation.
Right, so but we don't have that,
right.
As experimenters, that it's impossible.
That's
to
right. It's impossible
universe, so
to predict the exact outcome.
It's not even.
Okay, let me ask you. Let me turn this around. I gave this colloquium only once before last week. It's a brand new colloquium, and a person in the audience asked me a similar question. He said, "This is not beautiful that you're winding up in this state." I thought about it, and I spontaneously came up with an explanation. I think not an explanation, but a comment back. I think our notions of beauty are determined by what, in the end, it turns out to be true. You could have asked me the same question about quantum mechanics 100 years ago. Your theory does not predict which slit the electron goes through. It's not a deterministic theory. And I answer yes and no. It doesn't try to predict anymore which slit we go through, but it's still deterministic in the sense that I know how the wave function evolves as a function of time. Absolutely. I just don't know how the wave function is going to correspond to the actual outcome of which slit. Now I'm saying, I don't know which universe I land in, but I'm going to tell you very well statistically, which is what a wave function does, how things propagate across all different universes simultaneously.
But the predictions of quantum mechanics are not, what makes quantum mechanics falsifiable is not to give me the prediction.
I'm saying one has to... I'm
not arguing about beauty.
What I'm saying is that beauty is just one thing, but even the scientific questions of falsifiability and predictivity maybe have to be modified in light of a different kind of theory that we're talking about. However, I agree with you, and let me also say, I'm not advocating one thing or another. I'm just here to report what's going on out there. I personally am very uncomfortable with the landscape, but I acknowledge, perhaps, that my discomfort is because I'm thinking like a 20th century physicist, when maybe that wasn't appropriate. Like a 1960s particle physicist would have said, proof is the detection of an isolated particle. And we've never done that. We don't know there's a quark. We've never seen a quark. But we don't ask that kind of question. I mean, I'm quoting Lenny again, but he's very persuasive. But maybe the terms we use and standards by which we judge theories have to evolve when paradigm shifts evolve. These debates came along with quantum mechanics. It's not a theory. It doesn't predict which slit the electron goes through. But we now don't attack it for that. We say, okay, the standards are different. It's a quantum mechanical theory. We instead ask different questions about it. Maybe similar things have to happen here. I don't know. I'm just reporting that this is part of what it means to have a paradigm shift.
Okay, question. So you're saying that you are personally not very comfortable with civilization.
I have to admit I'm not.
Idea.
It's not what I've been a physicist.
Now we know that even just as a quantum field theory, say coupled to gravity, there will be a landscape of metastable states, I say just like, I mean, in the paper by Nima and
Schertz
and collaborators. So that is an old idea that had been there ever since the people, I mean, that is something that people just know, people could have known,
yes,
say half a century ago.
Sure.
So what is there that is not comfortable with? I mean, it is an old idea that was just there, even just in quantum field theory. Even just in quantum field theory.
That's right.
With pure gravity.
Right. What's so, new now?
That's your question.
What's new now, I think, is the realization.
So I mean,
yeah, people knew that there were these different possibilities. What people still thought was that there was going to be a way dynamically of determining which one was correct. And what's happening now is people are beginning to think maybe there isn't. And therefore, maybe all of these are going to exist without a dynamical or predictive method of knowing which one we land in. So maybe environment of initial conditions, for example, determines where we end up. And that's the new thought, the scary thought. And even that's not new. People have been talking about that for 20 years. It just sort of hit the particle community on large this decade. Yeah.
So there may still be a small set of space that we will land in.
Yes.
I think we will land in
mm-hmm.
eventually, but we're just not there yet. So
yes.
I guess the question is more like, so even if we figure out those small same number of states, they may not really be the states that we are in.
Yeah.
But that's fine.
That's right. We could, there may be, what he's saying is, you're right, it's a very good point. There may be a dynamical mechanism that will propel us into one state, but we're still bouncing around in the pinball machine of life getting there, and we're not there yet.
Yeah. So, I mean, I suppose you probably don't like this question, but, I mean, through the string vacuum project, you probably have developed a lot of, say, like, mental tools. What kind of other questions you can
try to answer? Let me just show
like
one. Let me just, by the way, in case you're wondering how many you saw flashed in front of your eyes.
Oh my God.
I'm trying to find.
Can you remember?
Why do we do this string vacuum project? I think the best explanation is this one. As string theorists, we ultimately are going to have to come to terms with the landscape as a whole. And just as in astrophysics, botany, fields ranging from A, B, all the way to Z, zoology, the first step in the analysis of any large data set is enumeration and classification. That's how you begin to do science. This is the Sloan Digital Sky Survey of string theory. I don't like it. 10 to 500 is a big number. I don't think we're going to find any strong statistical correlations that are 100%. And if you don't, you're not really making predictions. But on the other hand, as a string phenomenologist, I don't know what else to do at this moment but to begin to find my way in a new landscape. So I think this is a necessary first step, and I don't know where it leads. When they propose to look at the sky, they again don't know what they're going to find. The sky is infinite or almost infinite. Same sort of question. But I agree. I don't know. I don't feel comfortable with any of this. I'm reporting what's going on and why a lot of people are uncomfortable.
Okay. Let me just make a parenthesis. Does anybody mind if we delay the conference 5 or 10 minutes for time a little bit more discussion? Is that okay?
I do.
I wonder if we're running short of time.
maybe what we should do, because we have a kind of, I love
it's fine.
The discussion.
It's fine. Don't worry.
Keith is here.
I'm here all of today, all of tomorrow, a little bit of Friday morning.
Okay. So let me suggest that those of us who love this discussion, and I'm one of them, we look forward to further discussion with Keith. And one possibility is that we can make this, can have a table at pub night and hang out pub night and drink wine and beer. And
that's what it should be discussed.
Really.
So thank you very, very much.